We're pleased to welcome Kerry Reich to our series on statesmen who were never president. He's the author of a magisterial work on the life of Nelson A. Rockefeller. Earlier he wrote a number of portraits of the powerful and the wealthy, including the book Financier, the biography of André Meyer. Kerry Reich, earlier in his career, was the editor of Institutional Investors. The biography is a two-volume work. The second volume, he just said, was more likely to appear in 98 or 99 than earlier, as had been rumored. That's the way of publishers and publication. It's based on original research into the Rockefeller family archives, the FBI and the FOAI files, and interviews with 300 individuals, many of whom had never spoken on the record with regard to Governor Rockefeller. The reviewers are already comparing the book with the works of David McCullough, Doris Carnes Goodwin, and Robert Caro. Mr. Reich has received a number of highly prized awards, the Overseas Press Award, the Deadline Club Award, and the John Hancock Award on Excellence in Business and Financial Journalism. He lives in New York City, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the Miller Center.
Thank you. I feel like I'm in a Senate hearing here, and I'm about to be grilled by the distinguished bodies here. I got my remarks, and I'll read them into the record. But actually, I was at University of Virginia once before, which is to do the research for the book on the papers of Edward Stettinius, because Edward Stettinius was Secretary of State for a short period when Nelson Rockefeller was Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America at the end of World War II. And I actually learned a lot about Stettinius and found him to be a very fascinating character and often an underrated character. He was described by Averill Harriman as one of our most underrated Secretaries of State, and I can believe it. And among the people who underrated him was Nelson Rockefeller, who described him as a terrific handshaker, but he could simply not make a decision. The fact was that if we're looking for unsung figures in American history, he's one of the unsung figures, and you know, he's obviously an important person here at the university. The name of Nelson Rockefeller is still frequently invoked. It still has enormous historical resonance. To conservatives, he still is the great liberal boogeyman, the symbol of all they detest. That much was underscored during the recent presidential campaign. You may recall there was talk when Colin Powell was considering a run about how Powell was secretly a Rockefeller Republican. This identification with Rockefeller triggered an enormous backlash from the conservative wing. One conservative activist warned that if Powell got the Republican nomination, it would be as if Ronald Reagan had never lived and Nelson Rockefeller had never died. The conservatives also saw fit to allude to Rockefeller's death in other ways. One reminded his audience that Powell's supposed role model was a, quote, conspicuous philanderer, unquote. And later, Pat Buchanan, in the course of the primaries, warned that if Bob Dole selected a Rockefeller Republican as his vice presidential nominee, there would be a floor fight at the convention. At the same time, Rockefeller's name has recently been invoked in an approving way by other factions in the Republican Party, by Governors Christie Todd Whitman in New Jersey and William Weld in Massachusetts. Whitman has gone so far as to publicly identify herself as a Rockefeller Republican, which he described as a sort of republicanism with a social conscience. To me, all this certainly shows that Rockefeller, one way or another, still in a sense lives. In fact, for some people, he's a very living presence. I can tell you a story about when the book first came out, I was signing books in many bookstores, and one of which I signed at a Doubleday bookstore on 57th Street in Manhattan. And a friend of mine, a couple of days later, went to the bookstore, and after you sign these books, they put stickers on them, say autographed copy. And my friend bought a couple of copies of the book, and as she was paying for them, this man was watching her and looking at the sticker. And finally, he came up to her and he said, "Excuse me, ma'am, is it true that Nelson Rockefeller signed those books?" So he still lives, literally, for some people. However you felt about Nelson Rockefeller, you could not help feeling that this man was a force, an outsized presence, a phenomenon rare in American politics. He set the standard, for better or worse, of the imperial activist governorship. He was a singular embodiment of liberal republicanism. He defined that wing of the party. He dominated it, so much so that his downfall was the liberal wing's downfall. It never recovered. He also posed one of the great conundrums of 20th century American history, how someone with such vast gifts, such unbounded energy, such unlimited resources, such deep, wide-ranging experience could not have become president. Rockefeller truly was an incredible figure, and just how incredible he was is revealed just as much by what he was up to in the years before he became governor as it was in the years of his greatest renown. To prove my point, I'd like to take you back 43 years to the spring of 1953. After 8 years of public office, out of public office, Nelson Rockefeller has just joined the Eisenhower administration as Undersecretary of the brand new Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Now, when most men of prominence accept government jobs, they are compelled to resign from the handful of positions and board memberships they hold in the private sector. When Nelson Rockefeller accepted his position, here is what he had to resign from in alphabetical order: Chairman of American International Association, Vice President and Director of Ammon Israeli Housing Corporation, Member of the Board of Trustees of the Committee for Economic Development, Chairman of the Council for Inter-American Cooperation, President of Hills Realty Company, President of International Basic Economy Corporation, Chairman of the IBEC Research Institute, Chairman of IBEC Technical Services Corporation, Director of Madigan Highland Corporation, President of the Museum of Modern Art, Member of the Board of the National Council for U.S. Art in the United Nations, Vice Chairman of the National 4-H Club Builders Council, Vice President of the Pan American Society of the United States, Chairman of the Executive Committee of Rockefeller Brothers, Inc., Chairman of Rockefeller Center, Inc., President of the Venezuela Basic Economy Corporation, Vice President of the Westchester County Board of Health. He did, however, hold on to a few positions. He would continue on the board of the Fresh Air Fund and as a trustee of the Union Church of Pocantico Hills, and he would remain on the board of the Seal Harbor Village Improvement Society. This list is as good a snapshot as any of the world of Nelson Rockefeller circa 1943, 5 years before he became governor of New York, before he became the Rocky of legend and lore. What it gives us a glimpse of is the man's inexhaustible energy. Here he is at what might be deemed a slow period in his life. And at one and the same time, he is running Rockefeller Center, running the Museum of Modern Art, running a vast Latin American business empire, running the Rockefeller Brothers' joint philanthropic efforts, running the family estate in Pocantico Hills, and serving on a dozen public and private boards, including the board of the Seal Harbor Village Improvement Society. This is Nelson Rockefeller during one of the down times in his career. I think this says volumes about the man. It also says quite a bit about why I have spent 8 years, and still counting, tracking his life. On my desk at home, I have one of his old gubernatorial campaign buttons. It reads, "Rocky, he's done a lot, he'll do more." That button has become a personal watchword for me. It's as if Nelson Rockefeller is staring right at me, saying, "You've done a lot, and you're going to have to do a lot more." This is a man whose enigma was perpetually in overdrive, whose engine was perpetually in overdrive, well before he became governor of the Empire State. Back in the 1940s, when he was FDR's coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, Rockefeller would drive himself to work each morning and pick up various of his subordinates along the way. After a while, the subordinates decided they would just as soon find some other mode of transportation. Here's how one recalled the morning commute with Rockefeller. He drove as if he were piloting a Parisian taxi cab. He drove too fast. He drove too close to other cars. The rest of us were always mentally cringing and putting on the brakes. He didn't seem to give a damn. That was Nelson Rockefeller. As the wife of one of his closest aides recalled, "I cannot picture him static, standing quietly. He was always in motion." All of us who lived in the Empire State during the Rockefeller era saw that restlessness, that relentless drive at work during his governorship. We saw it in the vast array of programs that he launched, addressing everything from health care to the environment, to education, to housing, to the arts, to the state's transportation needs. We saw it in all the agencies he created during his governorship, the Housing Finance Agency, the State University Construction Fund, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, the Adirondack Park Agency, the State Council for the Arts, the Urban Development Corporation. We saw it as well in his monumental building programs around the state. Even today, maybe especially today, in view of our current attitudes toward government, the statistics are mind-boggling. 90,000 new low and moderate income housing units, 200 water treatment plants to curb pollution, 23 new state mental health facilities, thousands of miles of new highways, 4.5 miles of them for every day he was in office, and he was in office for 15 years. And of course, what he considered his crowning achievement, the great expansion of the state university system. When he took over, there were 28 campuses educating 38,000 students. When he left the governorship, there were 71 campuses educating 246,000. But for me, as I began to really delve into this man's life, what was most eye-opening was how much this same juggernaut quality characterized his years before he became governor, before he became Rocky. Listen to these descriptions of Nelson Rockefeller in the late 1940s. He goes a little like a madman from daybreak until dusk, and then he wants to talk things over with the experts until midnight. That was from someone who accompanied him on a business trip to Venezuela. And there is this recollection from someone who worked for him in the Rockefeller family office. He never stopped. He'd have all his memos read by 8 in the morning and then come into the office. By 4:30, you didn't mess with him. He was tired and ready to go home. But he was only ready to go home and freshen up for the set of players that were coming for the evening, all of whom tied into something else he was doing. He loved having multiple interests, huge multiple interests. A lot of people found this high-octane display maddening. I love this comment from Adlai Stevenson. And again, this is about Rockefeller in the 40s. The trouble with Nelson is that he has so many ideas, and they're so wonderful, but when you call him the next day about one of them, he's on to something else or off to Venezuela. But the fact was that while a lot of his ideas would vanish into the ozone, an amazing number became real. His life, I think, is illustrative of one of George Bernard Shaw's epigrams. A reasonable man adapts himself to the world around him. An unreasonable man expects the world to adapt to him. All progress, therefore, is made by unreasonable men. I think it's truly incredible what this one very unreasonable man, Nelson Rockefeller, accomplished in the 50 years before he became governor. By the time he was 31, he had forced out the original management that had run Rockefeller Center and had put himself in charge. And he put himself in charge as well of the Museum of Modern Art, which was just then coming into its own. By the time he was 40, he had created a whole new government position for himself, the coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, and was overseeing America's wartime relations with Latin America. Just a few years later, at the Organizing Conference for the United Nations, he created the framework for NATO and all the other post-war alliances. And then a couple of years after that, he was the driving force behind Harry Truman's Point 4 program of aid to the developing world. And then consider what he did in the administration of Dwight Eisenhower. He oversaw the first reorganization of the federal government since the New Deal, which created, among other things, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and the United States Information Agency. As HEW Undersecretary, he pushed through the most sweeping expansion of the Social Security system since its inception. Later, when he went over to the White House as a special assistant for Cold War strategy, he engineered the Open Skies program, probably the U.S.'s biggest Cold War propaganda coup of the Eisenhower era. This is just some of what Nelson Rockefeller was up to before he became governor of New York. There's a famous F. Scott Fitzgerald saying to the effect that there are no second acts in American lives. But in Nelson Rockefeller's life, that was certainly not the case. There was a first act and a second act and a third act. And what I've learned, and what I've tried to convey in my book, is that the first act, Rockefeller's years before he became governor, was as riveting as the later drama of his governorship and his presidential bids. I never intended this book to be a two-volume work, but as I was working on it, it became clear to me, and clear to my editor at Doubleday, that so much was going on in this man's early life, so much that was fascinating in and of itself, that there simply was no way to contain it all in one volume. So much of what marked the man we came to know as a national figure and as New York's governor, the grandiosity, the energy, the insatiable hunger for ideas and for other things, the ruthlessness, the obliviousness to cost and consequence, was already on display in the young Nelson Rockefeller. He was, as I make clear in my book, political long before he went into politics. In fact, you can trace his political savvy back to his very complicated relations with his father, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. John D. Jr. has, I think, to some extent been lost to history, sandwiched between his father, the great oil tycoon, and his overachieving sons, Nelson in particular. But John D. Jr. was a very formidable character in his own right. This was, after all, the man who built Rockefeller Center, who built the cloisters, who built Riverside Church, who preserved the Palisades in New York and Acadia National Park in Maine and the Grand Tetons in Wyoming. This was the man who founded and shepherded most of this family's great philanthropic edifices. If you visit the family seat at Kitekit in Pocantico Hills, you'll see in the dining room a portrait of John Jr. glowering at you from behind his wire-rimmed spectacles. It is a painting that truly does him justice. He was a very stern, forbidding character, and with no one was he sterner than with his own children. One very good illustration of this is a letter he wrote in the early 1930s to his oldest sons, John III and Nelson. Both sons were by then working for him in the family office, and at one point John pleaded with his father to make himself a little more accessible to them. John Jr., in reply, wrote the following letter. Either before I went abroad or after my return, when I had a luncheon talk with you boys, I think I said that you boys would always have the first call of my time for conference about any matter that you were seriously desirous of discussing with me. To that end, I suggested that you feel free to let me know any time when you had such subjects that you wanted to discuss, and that I would, at my early convenience, appoint a leisurely time for such a talk. I cannot promise to arrange for such a conference at short notice, but I'll always set a time at your request, and that too at my early convenience. That was John Jr. Nelson's first great political challenge was carving out a place for himself in his father's well-regulated domain. What he wanted most of all was to run Rockefeller Center, which was then still being built. And to do that, he would have to displace the management team his father had personally appointed. Rather than mount a direct challenge, which would never have worked with his father, he launched a spectacular flanking maneuver. He set up his own little business, which leased out space in Rockefeller Center, and from that little niche, he began to worm his way into his father's operations. He used that favorite bureaucratic device, the organizational study, to build up his position. He lined up a key strategic ally in his father's trusted counsel, Tom Debevoise. And then, when he had all his pieces lined up, he executed the coup d'etat, firing the managers and putting himself at the helm. It was accomplished so brilliantly, so stealthily, that his father, for all his misgivings, was utterly helpless to do anything about it. What you see Nelson doing again and again with his father is buttering him up, praising him, declaring in the most obsequious ways how great a man his father is and how unworthy he, Nelson, is by comparison. Some of this gushing prose is, frankly, positively nauseating to read. But it worked. What Nelson learned at an early age was that no matter how skeptical, no matter how worldly wise, no matter how hard-nosed his superiors, they would almost always succumb to outrageous flattery. Again and again, he would use this technique, first with his father and then with presidents and secretaries of state. When FDR was reelected in 1940, Nelson, despite the fact that his family had backed Roosevelt's opponent, Wendell Willkie, wrote Roosevelt that, quote, "Your reelection yesterday constitutes the greatest vote of confidence ever given any American," unquote. When, as coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, Rockefeller set up a scholarship program for Latin American students, using, I should point out, federal funds, he asked the president if it would be all right to call them the Roosevelt Scholarships. FDR had no objection to that. Then there's this wonderful bit of buttering up of FDR's Secretary of State, Cordell Hull. Hull had just returned from a wartime conference in Moscow, and Rockefeller rushed to the airport to greet him. And then he followed up with this letter to the secretary. "I can't tell you what a thrill I got when the wing of your great army plane swung out over the president's car and came to rest in front of the hangar. The door opened and you stepped out, returning from the most significant trip that any American has made since the start of the war. You have brought new hope and confidence into the hearts of the people in every home in this country." Undoubtedly, the most egregious instances of Rockefeller's fawning were in his dealings with Dwight Eisenhower. At one point, Rockefeller, who by then was working in the administration, advised Eisenhower that his new hobby was collecting Eisenhower's speeches with a view toward publishing them. Rockefeller told the president, by way of explanation, that, quote, "It seemed to me that you expressed basic American beliefs on current issues with greater clarity and penetration than anyone since Lincoln," unquote. And Rockefeller did more than just flatter Eisenhower with sweet words. He built a one-hole golf course at his house in Washington in the hope that he could lure the president there. Eisenhower never came. Out of his own pocket, he paid for the distribution of 20,000 official photographs of Ike to U.S. government offices around the world. And most incredibly, while he was working for Eisenhower at the White House, he continuously plied the president with very expensive gifts, all of which the president quite shamelessly accepted. He bought the table and chairs that Eisenhower had used in London during the planning of the D-Day invasion and presented the furniture to the president to commemorate the 10th anniversary of D-Day. And when Eisenhower casually mentioned one day over breakfast that his farm in Gettysburg was in need of some landscaping, Rockefeller brought in his own landscape architect to work on the grounds. Not very long afterward, an impressive supply of trees, oaks, elms, pines, spruces, red maples, sugar maples, arrived at Gettysburg, all courtesy of Nelson Rockefeller. I suppose most readers would be astonished that a Rockefeller would resort to such shameless flattery, but I think the flattery is simply a measure of Rockefeller's ambition and his readiness to pull out every stop to achieve his ends. There is, among Rockefeller's papers at the Rockefeller Archives Center, an astonishingly confessional letter he wrote to his mother when he was 24 years old. In it, he speaks quite frankly of what he describes as his, quote, overpowering ambition, unquote. He describes himself in that letter as being, quote, hard and unfeeling, and says, if one is going to get very far in this world, one must be impersonal and not waste one's emotional strength on irrelevant things. The result has been that I take a pretty cold attitude about most things. It is one of the rare times that Rockefeller indulged in a brutal self-analysis when he let down that great gregarious facade and showed the cold calculation that lay beneath. Where was the ambition aimed at? Obviously to become president. As he once admitted, he was aiming in that direction ever since I was a kid. After all, when you think of what I had, what else was there to aspire to? In my book, I show that as early as 1953, before Rockefeller had been elected to anything, in fact, before Dwight D. Eisenhower had been sworn in, Rockefeller was positioning himself for a presidential run. But unlike, say, Lyndon Johnson, Rockefeller was not after power for its own sake. He truly did see high office as a means to an end, a mechanism by which he could accomplish great things. He liked to view himself not as a politician, but as a problem solver. My interest is not really the politics, he once said when he was governor. My interest is the government and the administration, the solving of problems. I have a lot of energy, I have a lot of interests, and I see a problem and I immediately start to think about a solution. Then I have to get someone who can work on that. In many ways, Nelson Rockefeller was a policy wonk long before that term gained currency. During his governorship and long before his governorship, he loved brainstorming over policy and problems. Throughout his life, he was appointing and participating in task forces, study panels, and blue ribbon commissions, not because they were politically expedient, but because he really was energized by the give and take. He truly believed that no problem was insoluble if enough brain power and enough money was thrown at it. As Henry Kissinger once told me when he was reflecting on Rockefeller, cynics don't build cathedrals. And Nelson Rockefeller was many things, but he was never a cynic. Of course, his faith in problem solving was to a great extent based on personal experience. For Nelson Rockefeller, very little was impossible. When he needed the mantles over his apartment fireplaces decorated back in the 1930s, he brought in Matisse and Leger. When he coveted a yellow Rolls Royce and was told by the company that they had made only one and it wasn't for sale, he had a British intelligence operative sneak into the factory and scratch a paint chip from the car so he could repaint a gray Rolls Royce the exact same color. When the view from his Fifth Avenue apartment was threatened by the financial troubles of the Knickerbocker Club across the street, and there was talk that the clubhouse might be sold to a developer who would put a high-rise on the site, Nelson Rockefeller simply went ahead and bought the Knickerbocker Club himself, so his view would never be blocked. His approach to government was really just a natural extension of this mindset. What we all learned from the Rockefeller era in New York was that some problems were susceptible to this brains and money blitzkrieg, housing for one and higher education for another, but others weren't as susceptible, the most obvious being the drug problem. His arbitrary draconian drug laws, probably the toughest, most inflexible ever enacted by any state, were really a product of his desperation when all his standard approaches, the study groups and all the rest, failed. We also learned from the Rockefeller era was that there was a price to pay, a very big price to pay, for the Rockefeller approach in the form of a huge state debt. I think it's safe to say that the heedlessness that Rockefeller showed in his personal expenditures was echoed by his approach to the public purse. As his longtime Attorney General, Louis Lefkowitz, told me, if he wanted to spend money, money was no object. And that brings me to the phenomenon known as Rockefeller Republicanism. When Whitman and others talk about Rockefeller Republicanism, they speak about its social consciousness, its quality of caring. And that certainly was a good part of what Rockefeller was all about. But what these nouveau Rockefeller Republicans skim over is the rest of what Rockefeller Republicanism, as practiced by Nelson Rockefeller, was all about. Because the fact was that Nelson Rockefeller, for much of his career, really was a tax and spend liberal. He really did believe that government had the answers. Maybe not all the answers, but most of them. What is also largely forgotten now, or glossed over, is Nelson Rockefeller's foreign policy side. Nelson Rockefeller was the quintessential Cold Warrior. For most of his career, he was adamantly against any accommodation with the Soviets. He was against disarmament, against nuclear test bans. More than any other single public figure, he was responsible for instigating the mania over fallout shelters in the early 1960s. And indeed, as my book points out, it was his machinations at the United Nations Conference in 1945 that helped crystallize the post-war tensions between East and West. In the early 1960s, on a TV news show, Rockefeller was asked how long the U.S. and USSR could go on not trusting each other. Responded the governor, "Oh, I think you can trust them all right. I think you can trust them to try to carry out their stated objective of the domination of the world." It is no exaggeration to say that Rockefeller's views on the Soviets were not terribly different than those of Barry Goldwater or the National Review crowd that reviled him so much. And Goldwater himself, later in his life, admitted as much. As I pointed out in my book, Nelson Rockefeller was one of the few people on the American scene who could speak in the same breath of building more H-bombs and of fighting smallpox in the Third World. He was a hawk and a humanitarian at one and the same time, which of course serves to underscore just how complex a figure this man was. And as his biographer, unraveling that complexity, pursuing the contradictions inherent in a man who seemed to so many to be everyone's garrulous, backslapping uncle, is part of what has kept me going all these years. He was and is an elusive figure, even for those who worked intimately with him for years. I remember once in the course of my interviews with Happy Rockefeller, bringing up the question of the people who had worked for and advised her husband for years. I asked her, did she think he was well served by him, by them? And her answer was, I think they did the best they could with a man they didn't fully understand. I remember also talking to a man named Oscar Riebhausen, who had been a good friend and a legal advisor to Rockefeller for more than a quarter of a century. He told me, looking at Nelson was like looking up close at an elephant. A lot of us saw a piece of the elephant, and some saw more of the elephant than others, but none of us ever saw the entire elephant. He could be enormously compassionate and caring. In the course of my years of research, I've heard countless stories of how he privately, without any publicity, helped this person or that person through a personal crisis. Yet at the same time, he could be thoroughly ruthless in the pursuit of his goals. He could be the most open of personalities, yet, I have also learned, he would also display some strange streaks of paranoia. He was thoroughly organized and directed, yet at crucial moments in his career, he could often be fatally indecisive. Among his many contradictions was the contrast between Rocky, the blintz-eating, backslapping politico, and Nelson A. Rockefeller, the Lord of Pocantico Hills. Those of you who have had the opportunity to tour the Rockefeller home there, Kaikit, which is now owned by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, I'm sure gained some appreciation of the imperial style of the man. You get a taste of it with the Henry Moores and David Smiths on the terraces and lawns, and with that fabulous underground gallery with its Picasso tapestries, its Chagalls and Warhols. And I should point out that this was just one of the five homes the man had. It was also the house in Seal Harbor, Maine, the house on Foxhole Road in Washington, the duplex in Manhattan, and the hacienda in Venezuela. He truly projected a kingly aura. In my book, I tell the story, which was told to me by Happy, of the time the Earl of Mountbatten, who you may remember was the mentor of both Prince Philip and Prince Charles, visited Kaikit. In the course of an argument with Rockefeller, Mountbatten blurted out, "But Your Majesty," before he caught himself. And like any king, Rockefeller could be supremely out of touch with the day-to-day concerns of the average man. Once, in his first year as governor, he was discussing a tax increase with his aides, and someone began talking about the effect of that increase on take-home pay. Rockefeller interrupted him. "What is take-home pay?" he asked. All this serves to remind us that there was always more to Nelson Rockefeller than met the eye. There was always some aspect of the man that was remote and unapproachable. His life was never the open book it sometimes seemed to those of us who followed his comings and goings in the newspapers. And as we all learned, the manner of his death was equally elusive. I think it should come as no surprise, even to this distinguished audience, that Rockefeller's death is often the first and the second and the third thing people ask me about when they learn what I'm writing about. But I'm afraid I'm going to sound like a bit of a tease when I tell you that you'll have to wait till volume two. The only thing I'm prepared to say right now on the subject is that it appears that, like Alice's adventures through the looking glass, nothing was quite what it seemed. Nelson Rockefeller's life offers many other puzzles, and I'm sure none greater than the question of how this man, with all his wealth, all his gifts, all his drive and force of personality and ambition, could fail to gain the one prize that he sought more than any other, the presidency. With all he had going for him, his commanding personality, his command of the issues, his vast experience, his tremendous intuitive feel for politics, his incredible force of will, and of course all that money, how could he have missed it? This too is largely a subject for volume two. However, I think if you look closely at some of the patterns and tendencies in his earlier career, you can discern some of the reasons. I think you can see in his earlier life some of the traits and tendencies that were later proved to be decisive flaws. One of these is what I describe in the book as a sort of strategic blind spot in the man, a failure to see as he bulls his way toward an objective to the larger consequences of his actions. Time after time, you see evidence of this. Back in the 1930s, when he was first getting involved with the Rockefeller Center, you saw this in his hiring of the Mexican artist Diego Rivera to do the central mural at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. Rivera's devotion to the communist cause was world-renowned. This was an artist who had once done a mural of Henry Ford and J.P. Morgan partaking of a dinner of gold coins and ticker tape, and who just months before had created an uproar with a mural he had done at the Detroit Institute of Art that was denounced as a communist manifesto. Yet despite all these danger signs, Nelson brought him in to do the Rockefeller Center mural. And then when Rivera did exactly what would have been expected of him and painted the figure of Lenin into the Rockefeller Center mural, Nelson had to fire him. The subsequent destruction of Rivera's work, it wound up piled up in trash cans outside the RCA building, became a permanent blight on Nelson's reputation as a patron of modern art. Again, you saw this pattern show itself during World War II. Rockefeller became so caught up in his idea of true inter-American unity, and so caught up as well in his anti-communist crusade, that he turned a blind eye to the excesses of Juan Perón's regime in Argentina. Through an incredible series of backroom maneuvers and behind-the-scenes machinations, he forced through Argentina's admission to the UN. In the process, he almost wrecked the whole UN conference and humiliated his boss, the Secretary of State. And in the end, he lost his own job as Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America as a result of the uproar. Had he stepped back and considered the longer-term consequences of his actions, much of the damage, particularly the damage to himself, might have been avoided. Again and again, you see Nelson Rockefeller achieving short-term victories without fully considering how they might come at the expense of his broader strategic objectives. It brings to mind a comment made by that master political strategist, Prince Otto von Bismarck. "Political genius," Bismarck said, "consists of hearing the distant hoofbeats of the horse of history, then hoping to catch the passing horseman by the coattails. The difficulty is that one may hear the wrong horse or lunge for the wrong horseman." Nelson Rockefeller's great flaw was that all too often, at least in the national political scene, he heard the wrong horse and lunged for the wrong horseman. It is complexities such as these, the endless conundrums of Nelson Rockefeller's life and career, that partly account for why I've spent so much of my own life chronicling his, and why in 8 years I've never, ever been bored. I say partly because there is another big reason I've been so caught up in the pursuit, and that is the man himself. His sheer energy still truly is contagious. I know it infected me from the start and continues to infect me. I can recount to you something that one of his key gubernatorial aides told me once. What this man told me was that, and I quote, Those of us who ended up working with him held him in awe for different reasons. We weren't impressed by the name or the money. What we became impressed with was the man's incredible commitment to what he was doing and his drive and his energy. He was indefatigable. I mean, when most of us were probably half his age and we'd be, you know, pulling our weary bodies across wherever we were going, that guy was still going 90 miles an hour. I mean, it was just unbelievable. We used to look at him and we'd say, where the hell does he get the energy from? That energy really infused his political campaigns in a way that is largely forgotten today. Old-time political reporters told me that the only candidate they ever saw whose campaign could be compared to the energy and gusto of the early Rockefeller campaigns was Bobby Kennedy in 1968. It had nothing to do with all the money or the name, although that certainly helped create an aura about him. It had to do with the man. And in these times, when most of us have, to say the least, a lack of passion for the political candidates on the national stage, I think it's invigorating to recall a time when that passion did exist. I thought I'd close by sharing with you a passage from my book that I think captures what I'm talking about. It deals with Nelson Rockefeller's first political campaign, his successful run for the governorship against Averell Harriman in 1958. Meeting FDR for the first time, Winston Churchill once said, was like opening your first bottle of champagne. So it was, as well, with Nelson Rockefeller. His natural exuberance, his zest for life, his contagious joie de vivre were in full flower on the campaign trail. At Alfred University, he popped a blue college beanie on his head to the huzzas of 2,000 students. In Salamanca, he picked up a baton and directed the high school band, then grabbed a hula hoop and tossed it around his neck. At the Rensselaer County Fair, he trotted around the racetrack in a sulky, beaming and waving all the while. In Olean, he strode into W.T. Grant to pump the hands of astonished shoppers and buy a nickel's worth of green taffy. Appearing at Colgate University, Rockefeller delivered his set speech, then literally leapt off the stage to greet the cheering students. In Batavia early one morning, he shook up the bleary breakfast regulars at Victor's Open Kitchen, bounding in with an ear-to-ear smile, ducking behind the counter to greet the cook, the counterman, the waitresses, and the busboy, before joining a table of sleepy Batavians for poached eggs and coffee. "Hello," he introduced himself. "I'm Nelson Rockefeller. I'm running for governor." Rockefeller seemed, for all the world, to have been at the business of politics for years, rather than a mere 3 months. No one ever had to prompt him to shake hands. He grabbed at every opportunity to wrap his beefy arms around the electorate. Watching his father go overboard as usual at a country filling station, Stephen Rockefeller was heard to mutter, "Let's get him out of here before he starts shaking hands with the gas pumps." As a campaigner, Rockefeller had that rarest of gifts, the ability to not only win over the crowd, but to completely disarm those he encountered one-on-one. It was the same talent that FDR had, the ability to ensnare every person he met in the force field of his presence. He applied his solicitude to the humblest of voters. At the opening of the Democrats for Rockefeller headquarters in Midtown Manhattan, Rockefeller let the assembled bigwigs cool their heels while he talked for minutes on end with the cleaning woman. When an aide tried to pull him away, Rockefeller snapped, "Wait a minute, I just haven't finished with this woman yet." Aboard the Staten Island ferry one day, Rockefeller assiduously chatted up the bootblack while having his shoes shined. 2 days later, the man opened his mailbox and found a photo autographed to "my good friend Tony" and a personal note from Rockefeller, inquiring whether Tony might be available to work on his shoes again when the candidate made a return trip to Staten Island the following week. Rockefeller's attentiveness paid off big. Not only did it sway Tony, but Tony's many friends in Staten Island's Italian community, which accounted for more than 40% of the borough's vote. In a matter of weeks, Rockefeller had toured 39 of the state's 62 counties. In the process, he lost 6 pounds. His palms were heavily calloused from shaking as many as 2,000 hands a day. His untrimmed hair curled over his shirt collar. Somehow, he couldn't find time for a haircut. Yet at the end of another 18-hour day, he could still look out over a street corner gathering of all of 50 people and chirp, "This is terrific, really wonderful," and sound as if he really, truly meant it. The quintessential event in Rockefeller's first campaign, the event that solidified the image of him in the media and in the minds of countless New Yorkers as a hustling, man-of-the-people multimillionaire, was his visit on October 2nd to New York City's Lower East Side in the company of Louis J. Lefkowitz. Rockefeller had never before set foot in that part of the city, as he readily confessed when he arrived with his son Stephen on the appointed day. Despite the pouring rain, the group made its way through the soggy streets. Wearing his by now trademark battered hat and spattered trench coat, Rockefeller waylaid pedestrians and introduced himself. "You're kidding," one woman gasped. Then the party headed over to Ratner's Restaurant, a locally famous Jewish dairy establishment on Delancey Street. As waiters and startled patrons gathered around, Lefkowitz insisted that Rockefeller try the specialty of the house, cheese blintzes. Biting into one, his first blintz ever, Rockefeller pronounced it wonderful, absolutely delicious, terrific. As reporters scribbled and photographers flashed, he ambled around the restaurant, autographing waiters' checks, paper napkins, and menus, and advising patrons, "I recommend the blintzes." The next stop was Max Weitzman's Kosher Delicatessen, a short stroll down Delancey Street. There, Rockefeller munched on a corned beef on rye, donned an apron, posed for pictures with a 2-foot salami, and made the acquaintance of a counterman named Ben. Expressing an interest in the salami, Rockefeller asked Weitzman how much it cost. $5, the proprietor replied, but I'll sell it to you wholesale, $3. One of Weitzman's regulars was not amused. "For Rockefeller, he gives discounts," the customer grumbled. The pictures of Rockefeller toting his 2-foot salami, of Rockefeller and Lefkowitz hoisting their corned beef sandwiches, were plastered the next day in newspapers all over the state. Above all, there was the one indelible image, that of the grandson of the world's greatest oil tycoon and son of the world's premier philanthropist, happily wolfing down an oozing cheese blintz on Delancey Street. No longer was he Nelson Rockefeller, scion of Standard Oil. From now on, he was Rocky, eater of blintzes. The reception Rockefeller was getting around the state was rapidly assuming Elvis-like proportions. In Coney Island, Rockefeller was mobbed by a surging, cheering horde that overwhelmed the four policemen assigned as an escort. 16 more officers were summoned to handle the crush. Greeting some of the voters in Spanish and others in French, Rockefeller inched his way over to Nathan's for a hot dog with Jacob Javits in tow. When Rockefeller emerged from the tumult an hour later to board a BMT subway back to Manhattan, he proudly bore the scars of battle, rumpled suit, scuffed shoes, mussed hair, and a mustard stain on his jacket sleeve. In Spanish Harlem 5 days later, cheers of Viva Rockefeller rang out as thousands of Puerto Rican New Yorkers jammed a raucous block party for the Republican candidate. Tossing away his prepared remarks, Rockefeller ad-libbed for 20 minutes in Spanish, pausing only to ask the crowd, "How do you say?" when he was at a loss to translate such terms as 700,000 substandard homes. He promised to hold the line on the 15-cent subway fare. When one man shouted out that it should be less, Rockefeller shouted back, "Mira hombre, look man, one thing at a time." When he was finished, Rockefeller vaulted from the stage and was swallowed up by the swaying, dancing crowd. Seconds later, he reemerged, hoisted aloft on shoulders like a triumphant matador. "We're losing the candidate. He'll break a leg," one worried assistant groaned. But there was no stopping this jubilant tide, nor the candidate who bobbed along exultantly in their embrace. A policeman eyeing the scene threw up his hands in disgust. "He's mad, mad, mad," he said. That was Nelson Rockefeller. That assuredly is not Bill Clinton or Al Gore or Bob Dole. Thank you very much.
Did you ever have to cover?
Who'd like to make a comment or, yes?
It's been often reported that Rockefeller had some sort of dyslexic condition that schoolwork difficult for him. Mm-hmm. As an adult, how did he cope with that? What did you find, and how would you characterize his own written expression? How did he handle large amounts of written material on the policy issues? And in general, how did he cope with that in his adult life?
Well, he coped with it partly by having his aides write very short memos. He coped with it not very well in speech making, a result of which was his early speeches were terrible, and even his later speeches are very pedestrian. He was always uncomfortable speaking from a text. When he ad-libbed, he was fabulous, but speaking from a text, he was always weak. He did amass a lot of written material, but he often had very good people digest it for him. He rarely read books. He once said, "The best way to read a book is to talk to the author." And that's what he did. He was Nelson Rockefeller. He didn't have to read the book. He just called the author in and talked to him for an hour and get what he wanted out of the book. So there are a lot of ways that he, Nelson Rockefeller, compensated for it. Reading was a struggle for him all his life. He was not comfortable with it. But he often found ways to adjust. Often he would look at long columns of figures and say, well, the way to find where the anomalies are is to run your finger down the column and see where there's a bulge. And where there's a bulge, that figure's out of whack. We have to look at that figure. And so he'd often just trace his hand and see physically where the columns just jutted in and jutted out. And he would circle those numbers and say, what about this and what about that? So there are all kinds of ways he compensated for it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just wanted to say, when was he with the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare?
From 1953 to the end of 54.
Was his secretary Fleming at that time?
No, his secretary was the first secretary, Jovita Kolpavi. He effectively ran the department. She was there, she was testifying, she was the head of the current anomaly, but all the programs were initiated by him, all the people were really kind of reporting to him. He was the great driving force, not only in the creation of HEW through the reorganization panel, but in its early implementation.
Henry Thielfair?
My remembering of is a very interesting evening. You remember what was the sheriff's panel in New York?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The gathering of the all the power structure for these casual dinners.
Right.
Well, I happened to get there. I shouldn't have been there, actually. But Nelson, everybody's supposed to get there on time. That was one thing. Well, Nelson was sitting at the place for him at the next table, and the feeling was, the hell with him, go ahead. Nobody's going to wait for anybody to be late. But he came in about 10 minutes late, just sat down and started eating. But a little while later, he got up and addressed the group. And oh, there maybe about 50 people, something like that. And he said he was very sorry to be late. He knew that was very much out of order. But he had been in a very important legislative meeting, plotting, working on what was going to happen tomorrow morning in the Senate. And there was a bill being offered to charter a new bank, sponsored by a man, Abraham, something, but I don't remember his last name. But the only problem was that they're trying to solve is this man wanted to call it AB Bank. And they argued with him all evening about, you can't call a bank AB Bank. Mm-hmm. And the man answered and said, well, Oiding did.
Very good.
Elizabeth Scott?
What were his relationships with his brothers and with his children?
His relationships with both his brothers and children were very complicated. He was the dominant brother. There's no question about that. But his brothers, in their own right, became accomplished, successful people. And as they became more successful in their own right, they kind of chafed at his domination. He had a very close relationship with Lawrence. Lawrence was, in a sense, his closest friend. He confided in him. He talked to him all the time about his problems. Lawrence was really Nelson's closest friend. With John III, there was a politeness, and they worked together on things like Lincoln Center, but nonetheless, there was a certain remoteness about the relationship. David was the little brother, and he was always kind of getting kicked around a little bit. And Winthrop kind of detached himself from the family early on and was viewed, obviously, as the errant son for a while, then went off to Arkansas and became a figure in his own right, but again, distance from Nelson. The only brother he really had a close relationship with was Lawrence. As far as the children are concerned, he had a different relationship with the first set than with the second set. The first set grew up when he was moving into his career on his own, and as often was the case with men who are that driven in their early careers, they neglect their children. And while he kept close tabs on them, and in a sense wanted to manage their lives, he was a kind of a distant father. When he came home, it was almost like Santa Claus coming or some beloved uncle coming to visit them, because he was not home that much. And when he came, there was this explosion of joy. So he had a good relationship with them to some extent, but it was a complicated one. With his younger children, as again often the case with second marriages, there tends to be a making up for past sins and attempt to kind of bridge that gap, and he was much more of a hands-on father with them than he ever was with his older children.
Yes, Mrs. Yomke.
When Queen Wilhelmina came to visit Albany, mm-hmm. Governor Rockefeller was so ashamed of the mall that he decided to build a new one, mm-hmm. and they called it Rockefeller's Folly because he spent so much money on it, but I think it'll be a lasting legacy because it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Black marble and...
white marble, yeah.
It's really lovely. Also, New York State employees, he endeared himself to them because he raised their wages and benefits to be competitive with the other people in the area.
Oh, yeah, no.
So we loved him.
And were you a New York State employee?
Yes, I was.
Where did you work?
I'll tell you a story.
What area did you work in? What area did you work in?
In Poughkeepsie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was very good for the city of Albany, certainly. Although, as you may recall, there was a great deal of uproar in the city about his urban renewal plans, about wiping out what was called the gut, which is this area which was viewed by Rockefeller as a terrible slum, but many old-timers in Albany say it wasn't a slum at all. But he created this enormous edifice at no inconsiderable cost. It was multiple billions of dollars. And there are varying opinions about the artistic merits of this, but nonetheless, it did reshape Albany and made it look like a mecca as opposed to just another old Victorian city.
Yes.
To what period in his life do you take this first volume?
Right through his first election as governor in 1958. He has just been elected governor. It's election night and all that. And that's the end of the first volume. So the second volume encompasses the last 20 years, which is his entire governorship, all his presidential campaigns, his time as vice president, his time, you know, in private life, right up to his death.
I see.
There was a legend, at least, around New York where I circulated, that Nelson Rockefeller never made a mistake when Jameson, the oil man, was alive. He never made anything but mistakes after Jameson died. Is that a myth?
Yeah, Frank Jameson was his PR guy, and Frank Jameson was more than the PR guy. He was his great counselor. Jameson's advice wasn't always very good. I mean, Jameson, you know, would try to talk him out of the HEW job and the White House job, and practically every job that Nelson took, Jameson thought was a bad idea, and also try to talk him out of running for governor. But Jameson was a source of great counsel and great wisdom, and he was one of the few people that could say no to Nelson Rockefeller. Nelson, you can't do it. And Nelson would listen to him and not pursue it. So when Jameson died prematurely of cancer in 1960, in a sense, he created a gap that was never filled. There was no one else around Rockefeller who could be as abrupt, as rude, as forceful, and get away with it. And the result was that Nelson, to some extent, was surrounded by yes men, very capable yes men, but to some extent, yes men. And some of the major mistakes in his career, people felt, might not have been made had Jameson been around.
Other questions? The brothers developed a technique of guarding their turf a little against them, didn't they? John Rockefeller used to tell us that we'd be much better tending our own affairs than to have much to do with the brothers, or been unlikely we would have had with Nelson anyway, but he seemed to want to be sure there wasn't any intrusion by Nelson into the foundation.
Yeah. Well, they were always worried about Nelson because he was Nelson, because if you give him an inch, he'll take a mile. And I think, you know, with the brothers particularly, they were, from long experience, they had learned that you can't let Nelson through the door. And there was a great uproar when he came back to the family fold in the 70s after his vice presidential term, because every time he ever came back to the family fold after leaving government, he took everything over again. And all the brothers had their appointed posts, the Rockefeller Foundation, this and that, and he just walked right in and said, okay, I'm back, give me everything back again. And they would all give it to him. They would give him the chairmanship of this and the presidency of that, and Rockefeller Center, Museum of Modern Art, anything he wanted. But in the 70s, I finally said, no more Nelson, this is it. And he had a rough time accepting that, and there was a great deal of internal family struggle as a result of that.
How did it, was that the reason he took over Kaikit? Because that house is, I went there last fall, fascinating. I never had any respect for him at all.
The reason he took over Kaikit was, in a sense, was built for his grandfather, John D. Rockefeller Sr., by his father, John D. Rockefeller Jr. When Sr. died, Jr., as he was called, took it over. When he died, normally, in the primogeniture scheme of things, it should have gone to the firstborn son. But John III really didn't want it. He didn't like the pomp of Kaikit and all that. Nelson loved the pomp of Kaikit. He loved mansions and fabulous houses and all that. So he was delighted. You know, he was going to move right in. In fact, he built another house for his stepmother, Martha Baird Rockefeller, to live in, to get her out of there. And Martha was happy because she didn't want to live in that big old rambling house. And Nelson moved in, didn't do much with the interior. The interior was pretty much his, yeah. But the exterior, he just put all his sculpture and just remade it in his own image. And if you see these two wonderful sunken gardens, they were not sunken gardens when Nelson was there. They're swimming pools, okay? One of which had a
sink. Ice cream parlor for the boys.
Ice cream parlor for the boys, exactly. And one of the interesting things is after Nelson died, His brothers took over Kaikit. They filled in the swimming pools again. They tested the swimming pools, you know. But he decided he was going to...
The Chinese figures were in a plastic case so the boys wouldn't knock them down as
right.
they walked through.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he had children running around the whole place. And actually, he didn't mind them running around. They often had a very casual attitude. Once, I guess, as Nelson Jr. picked up this antique Chinese vase, it was, you know, maybe 1,000 years old, and he just laughed and said, you know, go ahead. He reshaped that whole area of the estate in his own image. So it's still when you.
But great, good judgment, I thought.
Oh yeah, his art taste was fabulous. And if you
that
really
was
look
his
at
mother,
the.
Mother, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and he was himself as well. He really studied art. He learned about art very carefully, and he had great aesthetic sense. And when you walk around Kaikit and you see how the sculpture is placed on the grounds, there is a wonderful placement. And things are juxtaposed that you wouldn't ordinarily think would work with each other. The angles, the way they reflect the light, the way they slope off the lawn. I mean, there's a care there and an eye there that is quite startling. And he was able to very confidently mix antique Chinese porcelain with modern art in his house, in his apartment, and make it work. Not many people can do that.
Victor?
Mr. Wright, when Governor Rockefeller engaged Henry Kissinger as an advisor, was that a first indication he might run for presidency?
Well, actually, it wasn't so much an indication. He engaged Henry Kissinger in 1955 or 56 to work on the Rockefeller Brothers studies, to study the future of America. And that was part, in the sense of creating a national forum for Nelson, but it wasn't, the engagement of Kissinger wasn't specifically for a presidential run. It was only later that Kissinger became a figure in that. But certainly, bringing Kissinger in showed how much he was geared toward big foreign policy efforts and making an impact in foreign policy. I don't think you can minimize the effect of Henry Kissinger. Interestingly, Kissinger wound up working for Richard Nixon after Rockefeller had lost the 1968 campaign, and I think he was viewed that with some suspicion by the Nixon people at the outset because he was a Nelson Rockefeller man. And in a sense, he was always a Nelson Rockefeller man. Had Nelson told him, "Well, I want you back with me," he probably would have dropped everything and come back then. Tremendously loyal to Nelson Rockefeller. And Nelson Rockefeller, to a great extent, made him, created attention to his ideas, made him an important figure, and you know, I think he recognizes the debt he owes Nelson Rockefeller.
Which way did the flattery go in that relationship?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I have seen correspondence from Nelson to Kissinger where the flattery is egregious toward Kissinger. But, of course, Kissinger learned from the master. And, you see that over and over again. You know? And his letters are as oily and, you know, as Nelson's were in his prime.
Your reference to John Jr. again raises this issue of the similarities but the differences in relation with families compared to one's real world, the business world.
Mm-hmm. For him.
When Dean Russ became president, John Jr. invited him to the foundation, mm-hmm. John Jr. invited him to lunch, and they had a very good talk, and it was very open, and he expressed his views on certain things, but not too aggressively. And at the end of the lunch, he thanked Rusk for having come to lunch. And he said this, he wanted him to know this was the first time and the last time he was going to invite him to lunch. And he said, however, if Rusk ever had anything he wanted to discuss, he'd be very glad to respond and glad to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it was maybe a softer relationship, and yet it's somewhat similar to what you say, call me, you call me, and I won't call you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Junior had his own style, and he also tried to detach himself from the foundation to a certain extent. He wanted to make clear it was an independent entity and not.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a sense, he became more of a figurehead than anything else. But that was Junior, that was his way of operating.
Yeah. Well, we thank you very much. We wish we'd had a larger...